I'm Kat, the host of Haunting History Podcast, the podcast that reaches back into the past to the stories and headlines that still haunt us today. Approximately 76.2% of abducted children who are murdered are dead within the first 3 hours of their abduction. In so many of these cases, someone saw something, suspected something, or knew something and never reported it. On June 26, 1980, Carrie Patterson, a friendly and outgoing 15-year-old, left her home in Fullerton, California to meet up with some friends. She never returned. 6 months later, her skull and portions of her remains were found in an oil field in Tonner Canyon, kicking off what would become a four-decade mystery, leaving her family heartbroken, a passionate cold case investigator without answers, and a newspaper reporter without an ending. Join us on November 4th as we talk to her family, the cold case investigator from the Orange County Sheriff's Department, and others still searching for who killed Carrie Patterson. Be sure to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Haunting History Podcast, and subscribe wherever you listen. Our cold case series starts November 4th.
Hi, y'all, and welcome to Kudzu Killers, Homicide, and Sweet Tea, where we like to share gothic tales of Southern-style murder.
I'm Lark, and that other voice you hear is Kim. Each week, we take turns telling you the gruesome details of serial killers, spree killers, and just plain old mean people that we find interesting, and we hope you do too. Sometimes quirky and weird, but always respectful.
So sit back, grab your glass of iced tea, relax, and let us take you step by step through our story. And feel free to shoot us a comment on a specific episode on our blog at kudzukillerspodcast.blogspot.com.
Now, let's get on with the show.
How's it going?
Awesome. How's your day?
I'm doing all right. I am supervising fence replacement and trying to write stories for us at the same time. So it's a full day.
It's always fun to write new stories.
It is.
And anybody that has, you know, suggestions, we are all ears.
I did want to mention one thing, and that's that we are on a new platform called Spreaker. And there's a learning curve with that for Kim because, you know, Kim's an old fuddy-duddy and likes, she gets used to something and she doesn't want to change. So,
but that's not totally true. She's our rock star IT tech. And without Kim, there would be no recording. So y'all cut her some slack while she's learning and then we'll rock.
Yeah. So they're inserting ads and some of them aren't in the right place. And that's because I'm not putting the brakes in the right place. So I will figure that out at some point, folks, but just bear with me.
Yes, she will. Cause she's amazing. We love Kim. Yeah, yay, Kim.
Yeah. Okay. Alrighty, so today we're going to talk about the Austin Yogurt Shop murders. I don't know if you've heard about this case or not, Lark.
I have. But I wasn't living there at the time, but yeah, I have heard about them. So, but tell me more. Tell me the details and stuff.
Well, this is kind of one of the more bungled up cases that I've read about. I mean, the detectives tried. But I think it just kind of got somewhere sidetracked and went the wrong direction. But it's definitely an unsolved case. They don't know who did it yet, or at least they don't know if they do. And it's got the FBI involved up to their eyeballs. So I'll tell you about that a little bit later.
Mm.
And it's called, like I said, the Austin Yogurt Shop Murders. And there have been a lot of suspects over the years and even a couple of convictions. Oh, but after all this time, the identity of who did this remains unknown.
So there were convictions, but still nobody. What?
All right, I'll get to it.
Okay.
I'll explain it all.
Okay. I'll wait.
It was almost 30 years ago, in December 6, 1991, when some unknown people or person went into the I Can't Believe It's Yogurt Shop on West Anderson Lane in Austin around closing time.
I know where that is.
I know you do. It's not far from where you used to live because I remember that street.
That's where I used to like to go to eat. Go on.
But these girls, Jennifer Harbison and Eliza Thomas, both 17, were working the closing shift that night, and they were friends and they loved working together. They were cleaning up. It was about probably, I don't know, it was getting close to 11. They were cleaning up. Jennifer's younger sister, Sarah, who was 15, and her friend, Amy Ayers, who was 13, had been hanging out at the mall for a while, and they were looking forward to having a sleepover. All four of them together were planning a sleepover. So the younger girls, Amy and Sarah, came over to the yogurt shop and decided to help clean up so that they could get out at 11 when it closed.
Right.
So now these girls, all four of them, were very good students, made good grades. They were involved in FFA, which is Future Farmers of America, for people who don't know. And they were just all around good girls. And so they were there, and the closing time was 11, as I said, and it was just before 11 when this story happens. A few customers that were there that night recalled leaving around a quarter till 11, and there were two men still in the shop. They were sitting in a booth, I think near the front of the store, and one was a dirty blonde with a fatigue jacket, you know, a camouflage jacket. The other one was a big burly guy.
Scary.
Now, just before midnight, an Austin Police Department officer was doing his nightly rounds in his car when he spotted smoke coming from the Hillside Strip Mall. He pulled in and realized it was a yogurt shop on fire, and he immediately called a dispatcher for the fire department. The firemen got there, put out the flames, and when they entered the store, they found three bodies.
Oh, no.
Three of the girls were stacked on top of each other, more or less like books or logs of wood.
Oh, my God.
They were naked. Aww. Their legs were splayed. They'd been bound and gagged with their clothing. And they were too charred from the fire to identify, but one had an ice cream scoop placed between her legs. The top girl on the stack had sort of fallen off and sort of lay to the side from them, and all three had been shot in the head.
Oh, my goodness.
By the time Detective John Jones from the Austin PD arrived, the firemen had called in three bodies, but they'd found a fourth. That was Amy Ayers, found in the tiny room in the back. She wasn't as burned as the others, but she had been shot in the head. It seemed like maybe they thought she had escaped the stack of girls, like she was underneath the top one, and that's why the top one had fallen off, you know, and that she had escaped and made it to the back room before they caught up with her. She'd been raped and shot in the head a second time because the first time sort of missed and didn't kill her, but the second time did.
Aww.
It did the job.
Yeah.
Now, I watched a 48 Hours episode on this called Innocence Lost, I believe is what it's called. Innocence, like plural of innocent, not innocence, like C-E. But he told, I think it was Aaron Moriarty who was interviewing him, he said, "For a long time, I shut out what I saw, just wholesale carnage. But we knew immediately that they were kids."
Aww.
He said, "I'd seen homicides, but not four, and not four all tied up, and not four stripped down, and not four burned."
Aww.
Now, because of this, these guys, Detective Jones and his partner, Detective Mike Huckabee, kind of got, it became personal for them, really. And they were very meticulous in their work. They didn't want to arrest the wrong guys. They didn't want to put the family through all that. If they got the wrong guys, then the families are relieved. And then it turns out to be the wrong guys, and the families, you know, let down and upset and feel the loss again. So they wanted to try to avoid that. So their work was very meticulous.
Good for them. That's awesome.
But Detective Jones said one of his toughest parts was having to deal with the parents the next morning when he had to look them in the eye and tell them that they're going to do everything in their power to make sure they got the people who did it.
Aww.
They worked the case for months, and it went on to years. The public demanded answers every time an anniversary came around. And Jones and Huckabee wanted them too, but they wanted the right answers, like I said. They didn't want to do the wrong thing. They interviewed suspect after suspect after suspect. And since the crime was so heinous and so awful, they kind of felt like this was going to be a pretty evil person that did this, right?
Because
these were all little girls, all young girls, and they just, it was just so horrific. They didn't they wanted to look for the right person, and they felt it could be Satanists. It could be, they just thought it had to be someone evil. And they wondered if it was a ritual of some sort, since they were stacked and it seemed to be, they were posed, and it seemed to be like serial killer kind of stuff.
Right.
And so they even talked to a serial killer, Kenneth McDuff, who at the time was confessing to everything under the sun. And he was on death row awaiting execution. And he told them if he'd done it, he'd tell them he did it because he'd be proud of it.
Right.
So he denied doing it. So lead after lead and person after person, nothing was panning out for these guys. It made it even harder that the firemen were called first. Because those firemen and that hose and that water washed away a lot of the forensic evidence that could have helped them with this case. It just wasn't there anymore because it had been blown away by that, you know, surge of water that they used to fight fires.
So you reckon that when the firemen showed up, the girls were still like burning and flaming and stuff?
I don't know. I would have no idea. I mean, the place was on fire, so, you know.
That's horrible.
Amy wasn't as damaged as the others because she had gotten to that back room.
Right.
But I mean, that's what they kind of had to do. They kind of had to put the fire out. The detectives couldn't go in with a burning building, and they didn't really know anybody was in there dead at the time. They just thought it was a fire. So they put out the fire, and it wasn't until after that that they found the murders.
Right.
So Jones and Huckabee agreed they'd accept confessions because they had several, but they wouldn't move on them until there was solid evidence. I mean, you know, some people will confess to anything if it'll get them some attention. And so they had like six people confessing, but they wanted it based on solid forensic evidence or anything that they could find, eyewitness, whatever they could find. They wanted evidence, not just because false confessions were too common. And, you know, they didn't want to base it on that and then try to take it to court with no evidence and the guys get off, right? Because you can't go find evidence then and then try them again. It's double jeopardy. So but they decided they had interviewed four kids that were their best suspects. And eventually Jones and Huckabee were taken off the case because they wouldn't arrest anybody till they had evidence. And lo and behold, a year or so later in 1999, four suspects were arrested. And they were four kids that they had spoken to, but they just didn't feel like they were the right ones.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't move forward with them for that reason. And there had been 342 suspects and 50 false confessions.
Oh, my confessions. God.
Six of them were written confessions.
Oh, my God. That's insane.
They really couldn't dig through it all. They dug through what they could, but they couldn't really find the right person to arrest.
That's incredible.
Then on his execution day, McDuff decided he'd confess to it and say he was the one that did it.
Just because, to give him more time?
Yeah, so he wouldn't get... No,
Lord.
Because Texas has an express lane, remember? And they figured they could find out after the fact whether he actually did it or not. So
that's true.
Confession was checked out after he was put to death and found to be false also. But anyway, in 1999, they arrested these four suspects. The new detectives did. They were four kids at the time. They were just 16 and 15 years old when this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And they had already, Jones and Huckabee had already interviewed them, and they decided they weren't good suspects. They didn't have any evidence against them other than the fact that one of them had been arrested at the mall for having a gun.
Mm-hmm.
The names were Maurice Pierce and his friends, Michael Scott, Robert Springsteen, and Forrest Wellborn.
Mm-hmm.
Pierce was 16 years old, and he's the one that had just been arrested at the North Point Mall for having a gun. And that was the same mall where Amy and Sarah had been hanging out before they went to the yogurt shop and died. These new officers decided that the boys followed Amy and Sarah from the mall to the yogurt shop, may have even given them a ride to the yogurt shop, and they arrested them. After hours of interrogation, Michael Scott confessed. He told them he was standing there, and before he knew what was happening, there was a gunshot, and then a second and a third and five in total. He told them
that
it was
would add
him.
Up.
Yeah. Mm. He told them it was him and Maurice Pierce and Robert Springsteen, and that Forrest Wellborn, who was only 15 years old at the time, was sitting outside in the Ford LTD they'd stolen, waiting for them to rob the yogurt shop.
Mm.
Now, they also interrogated Forrest Wellborn, who was, I guess they were all in their 20s by this point, because this had been 8 years later. So he was 23, the others were 24, and they interrogated him over and over and over again, trying to push him to confess, but he wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. He told them, "I didn't have anything to do with this. I don't know what you're talking about. This wasn't me. I'm not this kind of person."
Right.
So they couldn't ever get anything on him. Springsteen, though, after another hours and hours of interrogation, finally confessed to raping and shooting the girls. He had lots of details in his confession that were spot on, like
really?
The type of gun, the positions the bodies were left in.
Mm.
But there's no physical evidence against him. No DNA evidence, nothing but his confession and that of Michael Scott, right?
Why would these people confess? I do not get that.
Well, pressure.
Mm, true, true.
The prosecutors took Wellborn to the grand jury, even though he told them he didn't do it and they had nothing against him. And the grand jury would not indict them. They took him there twice, and both times the grand jury said, "We don't have enough evidence to indict this guy." So no.
Mm-hmm.
So he was let go, let off the hook. They let Pierce go for the same reasons, even though they felt he might have been the ringleader for the whole thing. But at this point, they had two confessions, and evidence or not, they took Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott to trial.
Wow.
And so when we come back from our break, we're going to talk about the trials and the aftermath of those trials, and what exactly does the FBI have to do with this whole thing?
Leave the Lights On is a true crime podcast with a paranormal twist. Join creator Eliza and her co-host as they explore terrifying true stories and chilling crimes. Growing up, Eliza had an odd obsession with the darkest desires of humanity and an insatiable curiosity about the afterlife. Now, each week, Eliza brings you tales that will make you want to lock your doors, hide in your room, and of course, leave the lights on. Available on Spotify and Apple Podcast.
Okay, so we're back to our story about the trials and the aftermath. Robert Springsteen was the first to go to trial, and after 3 weeks and 13 hours of jury deliberation, he was convicted and given the death sentence. Now, keep in mind, there's really no evidence against these guys other than those two confessions against each other. There's no DNA evidence. There's no eyewitnesses. There's no physical evidence. There's nothing to tie them to this, but they were convicted. He was convicted. I mean, he was sentenced to death.
Wow.
A year and a half later, Michael Scott was then tried and convicted, and he was given a life sentence. Why the difference? I don't know. Different jury, I guess.
Yeah, different jury, yeah.
And of course, the parents were very relieved. They were happy that there were convictions. At least they'd gotten some justice for their daughter's deaths after all this time. I mean, at this point, it's what? It's in the 2000s, and so it's been, 19 years.
Yeah.
No, it's not been that long. It's been 9 years, 10 years. I think it's about 10 years since the deaths of those girls, and they were relieved they'd gotten some kind of justice for them. But about 5 years later, those convictions were overturned on a technicality.
What?
Everyone is entitled by the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution to confront their accuser. But in the case of Michael Scott and Robert Springsteen, their confessions were used against each other, but they were never allowed to cross-examine each other at trial.
Mm.
And so their constitutional rights were violated. But the parents were the ones who felt violated, because here they thought this was exactly what Jones and Huckabee were afraid of happening.
Right, right. Trying to prevent for them.
Yeah, that's why they took so long and, never found anything, because there really wasn't a lot of evidence there. And they were trying to prevent this from happening. But the other new officers on the case thought they had something, and they went with it, and they got their convictions, but they were overthrown.
Oh, man.
And these guys, who most people considered the murderers of these girls, were now out of prison, free. And the parents were heartbroken.
Of course.
This was like losing their daughters all over again,
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, going back to Detective John Jones, one of the first detectives on the case, he'd already interrogated these boys and he didn't feel they were the killers.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, he was on the Innocence Lost episode of 48 Hours with Aaron Moriarty, and after the convictions were overturned. And he was, I guess you would call him, kind of annoyed mm-hmm. that he and his partner were never consulted by the new set of detectives when these guys confessed. They were never asked any questions about their investigation. They were never involved in that. They never consulted them about anything to do with these guys that they had already talked to and dismissed as suspects, and that kind of miffed him. And he watched in that program, he watches the confession of Michael Scott for the first time.
Wow.
And the first thing he thought was that the confession was coerced.
Mm-mm.
He said that Scott, he noticed right away that Scott used the word accelerant about the fire.
Huh.
He said he smelled accelerant.
A kid and like Jones, that wouldn't say that.
Right. Jones felt that's a cop's word.
Right.
The normal person would say lighter fluid or gasoline mm-hmm. or alcohol, not mm-hmm. accelerant.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But Scott said accelerant. And up until then, Jones pointed out that he'd answered questions with single syllable words. He hadn't said anything with four syllables.
He probably
even
didn't
two.
Even know that word.
And then later on, in the full interrogation video, it appears that one of the detectives holds a gun to Scott's head and says, "You need to say something really bad, buddy, because this next phase is coming really quick and your opportunities are diminishing."
Oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
This is totally
I'd call
not
that
good.
Coerced, wouldn't you?
Yeah, buddy. Oh my God. Ugh.
But even though their convictions were overturned in 2006, they weren't freed until 2009 and 2010 because the state decided to appeal the decision. So these guys hung out in jail for another 3-4 years. And even though they're now free, they've not officially been found innocent. So those murder charges still hang over their heads.
Which also doesn't help them in the long run.
No. Now enter that DNA evidence I talked about. They had a little bit of DNA evidence from Amy Ayers, but there wasn't anything they could do about it in 1991. Well, now we're in the 2000s, and they could do that. They could do something with that DNA now, and they did.
Exactly.
There are new techniques by that time that could use tinier and tinier bits of material to extract a DNA profile from, and they had extracted a DNA profile from Amy Ayers. Now, Amber Farrelly, one of the defense attorneys for Scott and Springsteen, believes the DNA holds the key to telling us who killed those girls. One thing we know for sure, that it didn't belong to any four of those guys that they arrested for these murders. It doesn't belong to Springsteen. It doesn't belong to Scott. It doesn't belong to the other two guys, either Pierce or Wellborn.
So they still didn't completely clear them for it, even though it didn't belong to them.
Right. They still haven't been completely cleared of it, that I know of, that I could find anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we know they aren't the ones, right? Because
wow.
There's no DNA there.
Mm-hmm.
But it does belong to someone, and Farrelly says she's determined to figure out who so that she can clear their names once
Good
and for
her.
All.
Mm-hmm.
She told Aaron Moriarty on 48 Hours, "I know exactly who killed those four girls. I have his DNA profile. I just don't know his name."
Wow. Awesome.
Now, the problem all along with this case has been where the yogurt shop was located. It's right there between two major highways in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe you told me the name of the highways, and I can't remember. 183 and
Mopac.
Mopac, that's right. Mopac.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's right in between those two big freeways. The 183 jumps over to 35, so mm-hmm. they had easy access to get out of there. And there was over $500 gone from the till. So I'm thinking a couple guys went in there to rob them at closing and got slap happy and decided to do the other stuff too, and then just jumped on the freeway and took off. That's what I think. That's sort of what Farrelly said too. She said she believes they were most likely there waiting. And now we go back to those two guys that the people that were last in the yogurt shop and bought their sundaes
saw in there.
The dirty blonde in the fatigue jacket and the big burly guy in the black jacket.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But we may never know who did it because the FBI is refusing to cooperate in the investigation.
What?
In 2017, 26 years after the murders of Amy, Sarah, Jennifer, and Eliza, a detective in the Austin Police Department working the cold case entered that DNA. It was male DNA. That was the test that they used, called Wyster. Mm-hmm. And it's a man's DNA. It's attached to the Y chromosome, and it will only identify male relatives of the suspect.
Interesting.
He entered that profile into a database at the University of Central Florida and found a match.
Hello, we're back in freaking Florida, aren't we?
Oh yes, my God. Yes, we are. I tell you, it always rolls back to Florida.
Oh my God. All roads lead back to the swamp.
But investigators found out that the matching sample was uploaded by the FBI for a population study. And they requested that the FBI release that person's identity so they could identify a possible suspect through familial DNA, which is what we've been talking about all along.
Right.
They would know that person mm-hmm. is related to the person who mm-hmm. did this crime. But the FBI refused, saying it was a population study, it was anonymous, and they felt it could lead to the false accusations of a family member of the guilty person rather than the actual murderer. They didn't want to risk the privacy of the family or risk possible prosecution of an innocent person who just happened to be related by blood to the murderer.
Wow.
Now, that doesn't make any sense to me because they're using familial DNA right and left from things like Ancestry.com.
Exactly.
They just put the Golden State Killer away using familial DNA.
Right. Well,
so why they don't want to do it for this, I don't know, except that they said it's privacy issues. They did the tests anonymously and they don't want to deal with any lawsuits, probably.
Well, so how long ago was this? Maybe it just wasn't that.
It's about the same time. About the same time that they, it's about 2017, 2018. So about the same time that they're doing this Golden State Killer and the other person that I profiled that they had found out did a murder in Oregon, McFadden.
Well, I'm telling you what I would think. I think there's been some money change hands right up in there, but that's
I don't know if it's that or if it's deeper than that, if there's some other case that they're protecting.
That
or I guess it could just be that they did that study on the promise of anonymity, and if they break that, then good luck getting anybody to test for you in the future, right?
Yeah, or possibly the people that did test for them could maybe even sue the FBI, or I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so maybe they're just looking at dollars and cents again, and mm-hmm. they've got to keep it quiet, which sucks.
But that made them jump real quick on that website and put a disclaimer that said saying it doesn't function as a law enforcement database and cannot be used to identify a particular individual whose sample is in the database.
Wow.
All donors are anonymous and samples cannot be traced back to specific individuals.
I know a lot of people that don't want to do the DNA thing because of this very thing.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I got somebody that killed somebody in my family, I want them to get deserve.
I'm sorry, you may be
my cousin and I love you and I may have known you all my life, but you know, if you murdered somebody, you deserve what you get.
Right. That's totally a different ballgame. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking to protect you.
Exactly.
So, you know, hey.
But this fight's gone all the way to Capitol Hill with Congressman Michael McCaul from Texas. I think he represents the Austin area. Mm-hmm. Trying to work with the prosecutors to gain the FBI's cooperation in this investigation. But the FBI still refuses, claiming the privacy issue. Mm-hmm. And they also are saying, yeah, you know, it could lead to 1,000 matches and you'd never know how to dig them out. But I personally wouldn't care. You got 1,000 guys, go through them one at a time. It's not like it's been 30 years. It's not going to be that much longer.
You know? Hey, you had 300 that earlier. Now you've got a few more.
Yeah.
Wow.
So do you think they should release the information?
I do. I think that it overrides.
I think murder overrides, especially a quadruple murder. I think it overrides privacy issues.
Personally. Yeah. And I mean, I just really do. I think it could be handled mm-hmm. properly and it overrides it.
So anyway, that's our case for this week. A couple of side notes. In 2010, one of the original four suspects, Maurice Pierce, was pulled over for a routine traffic stop. He fled the scene on foot, and the officers that stopped him chased after him. One of the officers caught up to him, and Pierce drew a knife and stabbed the officer in the neck.
Lovely
the officer
individual.
Managed to pull his service weapon and shot Pierce dead.
Wow.
And the officer survived.
Well, good for him.
And then sadly, on March 24th, 2015, Maria Thomas, Eliza's mother, passed away unexpectedly while visiting Austin from her home in New Jersey without ever knowing who murdered her daughter.
Aw, that's pretty sad. Well, I just can't even imagine because, I mean, as a kid that age, I was working in an ice cream. I was working at the ice cream shop at Six Flags, you know?
Yeah.
Who'd have thought you'd have any trouble dipping ice cream, you know?
Yeah.
It should be the sweetest job in the world.
But, this case is still open. This case is still cold. It's not cold, actually. I think they're still actively investigating this case. And if you have any information, if you know anything about this, call the Austin Police Department. They would be happy to get your call.
Wow. I just have gooey chills.
Oh, yeah, it's such a sad story.
It is a sad story, but these, I'm glad that you
I hope they
time.
Find the guys. I hope that the FBI can be convinced that this is overrides privacy laws and that they can be persuaded to hand over that information. Even if it's possibly 1,000 guys that you know, match that Weister profile, who cares? You know, they'll work through the 1,000 names eventually.
Right. Well, I just think it can be handled appropriately that they could still use this opportunity because it is an opportunity
sure.
to solve this murder, you know.
Absolutely.
So we just have to hope that the FBI has a conscience at some point, you know.
Maybe.
Because they're basically good guys. But
they
every
are.
Now and then, this is a poor choice, in my opinion.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I'm like I said, I'm sure there's all kinds of legal ease all rolled up into this. And maybe eventually the congressman and maybe he can get some more on his side can talk them into doing something.
Right.
And maybe they can promise not to go after a fourth cousin of this person or something like that. I don't know. I don't know if this DNA profile, the Weister thing, actually gets that close of a relation or if it just identifies people with the same segment of DNA matching. And it may just do that. And they may be right. There may be 1,000, there may be 2,000 guys, but I'd rather go through those 2,000 names individually and rule them out than know they know there's somebody out there that matches that. They've run it through the database.
And there's such a chance that whoever's still out there is older and wiser and have done many more horrific things.
Yeah, probably.
You know.
Probably.
If you could do that to 4 sweet little girls, I'm sure that they have had other situations. And
you just
don't know. But thank you for bringing that to us.
Sad story. It was hard to work. So much information out there. So many websites with information. Like I said, I watched the video a couple times from 48 Hours. I found a lot of newspaper articles. A lot of it will be on our info page for the episode. So if people want to get more information, if they want to watch the full things or read the full articles, they can. If they want to know more information, but it's just sad for the families. It's
if you have
sad for the officers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do have. I've got the links to all the stuff, and I will be posting that. And so people want to take a look at it, they can.
So,
alrighty.
Thank you again for sharing with us, and thank you guys for being with us. Hope to see y'all on Friday. Do you know what our next story is on for Friday? Our Forensic Friday Fest, fun filled Friday.
No,
you do not know.
I don't have my list in front of me of what goes when. So.
Okay. All right.
Sorry. You'll just have to stay tuned.
All righty then. Okay. Well, Fridays are a lot of fun. And if you haven't already checked one out, do so. And we will see y'all soon. Thanks.
Bye-bye now.
Bye, y'all.
That's our episode for this week. Thanks for listening to us. And we hope you join us again every Tuesday for an exciting new episode.
Head on over to our blog at kudzukillerspodcast.blogspot.com and leave a comment or your ideas about the subject this week.
Or follow us on Twitter at kudzukillerspod. And you can shout out to us anytime or send a question for our next Q&A.
Yes, ma'am. And we'd love you.
forever if you leave us a review on whatever podcast blows your skirt up. We'd love to hear what you think about our show.
If you'd like to become a part of the Kudzu Killers family, hop on over to patreon.com/KudzuKillersPodcast and take a look at the goodies you get when you show us some love.
That's right. And if you love our music, check out Jody Jennings Music on Facebook, SoundCloud, or all social media and streaming music platforms.
So until next week,
or if we decide to shoot out a mini episode,
bye y'all.
Bye, y'all.